Chapter 6. Nadezhda Yakovlevna, Monday, the 7th of May, 1934. Spread-eagled on our mattress, Mandelstam listened to the siren song of the sea-nymph, and, to my immense relief, managed to resist being lured to destruction on the rocks surrounding our citadel. Since the night of that poetry reading back in January, Zinaida had more or less separated from her agronomist husband. She hadn't actually moved in with us, bag and baggage. She was careful to make it appear she was still living with her husband, so as not to jeopardize her rights to their flat, and eventually her Moscow residence permit. But she had taken to spending 2 and sometimes 3 nights a week with us in Herzen House, more often than not in our bed, the other times on a thin mattress in the tiny kitchen, if my husband was exhausted or preoccupied with what I delicately called his mountaineer mission. The timid mistress of shame-faced glances, with her burning cheeks and incendiary orgasms, half-stifled in deference to the thinness of the walls of our bedroom, had become adept at the protocol of a ménage à trois. She devoted as much attention to me as she did to my husband, partly to compensate for his paying more attention to her than to me, partly, I flatter myself, because she found me, as I found her, physically attractive and sexually stimulating. Mandelstam is on record as saying that loving a third person is not without risks, though the risk in this particular instance was not his falling insanely or even sanely in love with Zinaida. I can say that she was the kind of sexual animal who shrinks on you with time. Her constantly on display intelligence, her fastidiousness, her gushing admiration for the poet were already wearing thin. What remained was her body. And what a body! She was one of those females who didn't object to being lusted after for their bodies, and only their bodies. And even I will concede her adroitness at certain techniques of lovemaking normally associated with harlots, which is to say, no major orifice was left unexplored. Not one. Mandelstam, enthralled by the newness of the delectable corpus at his disposition, and somewhat awed by what I might call the exotic smorgasbord set out on the sideboard, tended to forget that I was present as a participant and not a spectator. I suppose the phenomenon of the male focusing on the third person singular, to the exclusion of the tier in his life, is the hidden pitfall of all love triangles. I must remember to compare notes on the matter with Akhmatova one of these days. Where was I? On the morning of the day I proposed to recount, Zinaida stirred in my arms, sleepily fondling my breast with one hand, reaching out for Mandelstam with the other. Finding his side of the bed empty, she sat up abruptly. "Did you manage to get some sleep?" I asked.
"Afterward I did. After our beautiful white night. My God, that husband of yours is insatiable."
She looked around the tiny bedroom.
"Where has he gotten to?"
"He's been up for hours," I said. "You can hear him pacing in the next room."
"Is he composing a poem?"
"So it would seem."
"For me?"
I had to keep from smiling.
"Not for you, darling girl. Though perhaps he will let you interpret it into existence, as he says, when it's completed."
Talk about insatiable! She melted back into my arms and started caressing my skin with the tips of her fingers.
"It's true what you said about women's bodies being far more attractive than men's," she said.
Her hand worked its way down over my pelvis.
"It's no accident that all the great sculptors and painters preferred the female nude to the male. Our skin is silkier, our curves softer, our sensual penetralia trickier to locate. But once located, effortlessly stimulated. Isn't that so, Nadezhda?
I cannot exclude that I was unable to articulate a response.
I especially love our breasts, she went on. Sometimes I caress my own to remind myself how beautiful women are.
Did you love your agronomist the way you love us?
You are mocking me, Nadezhda, aren't you? I married the first man I slept with, and I slept with the first man I came across who had a Moscow residence permit. He was my ticket out of the Urals to civilization. Can you see me spending the best years of my life in a repertory theater in Perm?
Surely your agronomist has redeeming features.
Oh, he does. He definitely does. He comes equipped with 22 square meters in a communal apartment off the Arbat. He has a job with a regular salary and the use of one room in a communal dacha on the low bank of the Volga for holidays, no matter that brats with runny noses swarm like locusts. Best of all, he is on the road for weeks at a stretch to study which seeds are best suited to which climates, which is his area of expertise.
When the cat's away, the mouse will play, I teased her. She confirmed my supposition with one of her shame-faced glances.
Whenever he returns home, it is too soon. Marriage to my agronomist, who is 100 years older than I am.
12, I corrected her.
12 solar years, but 100 psychic years, she insisted. Marriage to him transformed our Moscow flat into a cage, with fixed hours of the day for eating and defecating, and fixed days of the month for copulating. I often thought I'd be better off on my own, but I didn't want to abandon the flat, and with it my precious Moscow residence permit, both of which are the price I must pay for a divorce. If it came to it, I think I could actually bring myself to kill for a residence permit. Tell me honestly, do you think I am wicked?
We all of us make compromises to keep our heads above water in this workers' swamp. By the way, I saw your agronomist when my husband and I came backstage the night you played one of the sisters in The Three Sisters. As men go, he isn't all that bad-looking.
Can you explain, dearest Nadezhda, why women like us are attracted to men in the first place? We know next to nothing about what goes on in their silly heads. There are occasions when I look at their bodies and want to gag. Objectively speaking, the penis, dangling limply like the trunk of an elephant between their hairy legs, is the ugliest body part on a male. And yet when I catch sight of the swelling in a man's trousers, my pulse quickens. I long to touch it, to kiss it, to warm my lips with chamomile tea and accept it. Ah, Nadezhda, to welcome it into my mouth.
She shuddered in my arms.
Only thinking such thoughts could give me an orgasm.
Good thing for you it's the men and not the women who lose a day of their life with each orgasm, I said jokingly.
Good thing, she agreed seriously. When all is said, we have it so much better than the male of the species, don't you agree?
Speaking of tea, I could do with a cup, I told her.
What a rich idea, she said.
I threw Mandelstam's old robe over my shoulders and, walking barefoot, headed for the kitchen to boil water on our small paraffin stove. Mandelstam, wearing the second-hand silk robe I'd gotten him with money I earned for a translation, was so absorbed in the intricacies of composition, I don't think he was aware of my passing. When I returned to the living room carrying a tray with cups and a pot of tea, I found Zinaida wrapped in a quilt from the bed, one lovely bare ankle jutting from under it, curled up on the sofa. She was watching in bafflement as Mandelstam paced the room, 4 long strides in one direction, then 4 long strides back, all the while puffing frenetically on a cigarette. I settled down next to her and filled 2 chipped cups with tea,
and we warmed our hands around them, waiting for the boiling water to cool. From time to time a moth flew near Mandelstam's head. The walls of Herzen House were insulated with felt, which provided a thermal breeding ground for insects. Mandelstam's concentration was so absolute he was able to backhand the moth away without being aware of its presence. It occurred to me he would not take any notice if one of those new air attack sirens being installed around Moscow, now that Hitler was in power in Germany, began yowling. His lips worked, words and then phrases formed. I could almost hear the poem knocking like a fist on the window. And then Mandelstam stopped in mid-stride and looked over at us as if he had only just discovered we were in the room. He spied the moth near his nose and, emerging from a trance, went after it as if this particular insect was the culprit responsible for the hole he'd recently discovered in his knitted sweater. Clambering over furniture, clapping his hands wildly, the great moth-hunter scrambled around the room until, victorious, he held up his right palm to show us the small spot of blood.
"I think I got it," he cried.
"The moth?" Zinaida said.
"The poem," Mandelstam said. "The epigram to Stalin."
Zinaida, thinking Mandelstam had given in to the many friends who implored him to compose an ode in honor of Stalin, looked relieved.
"I know it must have been difficult for you," she told him, "but I for one think you were wise to do it."
I hooked my arm under her elbow. "You don't understand, darling child. Ossia has surely composed a very outspoken poem, one that doesn't beat about the bush. You and I will be his first readers." She looked puzzled.
"But there is only one sort of poem you can compose when the subject is Stalin."
Mandelstam's gaze came to rest on the glass ashtray on the windowsill, overflowing with cigarette ends, mostly but not all his. I wondered if he had spotted the ends from a strong cigarette he himself never smoked when we returned to the flat the previous afternoon. Shutting his eyes, exposing his pale throat, he raised the palm with the spot of blood on it over his head and began to recite.
"We live deaf to the land beneath us. 10 steps away no one hears our speeches. All we hear is the Kremlin mountaineer, the murderer and peasant slayer. His fingers are fat as grubs, and the words, final as lead weights, fall from his lips. His cockroach whiskers leer, and his boot tops gleam. Around him a rabble of thin-necked leaders, fawning half-men for him to play with. They whinny, purr, or whine as he prates and points a finger, one by one forging his laws, to be flung like horseshoes at the head, the eye, or the groin. And every killing is a treat for the broad-chested Ossete."
Mandelstam, transfigured, looked hard at me, an unmistakable gleam of triumph in his eyes, and it finally dawned on me what he meant by dead but not yet buried. Looking back at this defining moment in our lives, I ask myself, how did I really feel? I suppose I was thrilled and proud and devastated all at the same time. Thrilled by his audacity, proud to be an accomplice in an act of pure defiance, devastated that his instinct for survival, his as well as mine, was effectively moribund. As for Zinaida, she jerked her ankle back onto the quilt and wilted against my arm.
"Murderer and peasant slayer," she groaned. "But you simply cannot do this to me, Ossip. What will happen when they learn I was present when you read this out? Oh, my God! There could be a microphone in the wall. They could be recording every word we say right now. Nadezhda, if he isn't willing to act sanely, you must act sanely for the both of you and talk him out of this folly."
The more she protested, the more I supported him. I was, after all, the wife.
she was only the occasional mistress. "Get hold of yourself, Zinaida. Ossia has paid you the ultimate compliment of making you one of his first readers. Only the chosen few will know of the existence of this epigram. Whatever happens, you can be certain neither he nor I will ever reveal you heard it."
Mandelstam sank to his knees before the two of us.
"Zinaida, you must not breathe a word about this to anyone. If they find out, it could cost me my life."
She nodded miserably.
"Nadenka will memorize the epigram, as she memorizes all my poems. But I have decided that you should, too. If something happens to us, the poem absolutely must survive."
Zinaida tugged the quilt more tightly around her naked body, as if it could somehow shield her from an inconvenient request.
"Repeat the lines after me, both of you," Mandelstam said firmly. "We live, deaf to the land beneath us. 10 steps away, no one hears our speeches."
"We live, deaf to the land beneath us. 10 steps away, no one hears our speeches."
"All we hear is the Kremlin mountaineer, the murderer and peasant slayer."
"All we hear is the Kremlin mountaineer, the murderer and peasant slayer." Having memorized Mandelstam's verse for years, I had an instinct for the rhyme and rhythm and layers of multiple meaning buried in a text, for where the slight pause for breath fell. It didn't take me long to commit the 16 lines to memory. Zinaida was having a harder time of it. It quickly became apparent that she had no ear for the inner music of a Mandelstam poem. She would get 4 lines right and then mix up the punctuation, or even the order of the words, when she came back to them. Tears of frustration filled her eyes.
"I detest being put on the spot. I can't memorize this the way you do. I must see it written down so I can picture the words. That's how I learn my lines for the theater. Even as a child I had to write things down in order to remember them."
My husband and I exchanged looks.
"What do you think?" he said.
I shrugged. "As long as we can be sure the paper is destroyed once she has committed it to memory." Zinaida looked relieved.
"I swear I'll burn it," she said. "Next time I come by, I shall recite it without an error."
Mandelstam fetched pen and paper. Crouching at the suitcase, using it as a desk, he wrote out the epigram. Zinaida went into the bedroom to get her clothing and emerged dressed a few minutes later. Mandelstam read over what he'd written to make sure it was exactly as he wanted, then handed the paper to Zinaida. She folded it in half and then in half again and tucked it inside her brassiere.
"I am grateful you're willing to do this," Mandelstam said.
"I am grateful to be part of your citadel," Zinaida replied nervously. "I am thrilled to have your trust."
"Perhaps you should be on your way before the conversation becomes too syrupy," I suggested. I remember adding, "Don't forget to burn the poem." I recall Zinaida's confident,
"You can count on me."
After she left, I dressed and busied myself straightening up the bedroom. Through the open door, I could see Mandelstam sitting on the sofa, staring at the ceiling, occasionally clapping his hands together to kill a moth that had wandered within lethal range of him.
"Do you think I did the right thing?" he called out to me.
"Are you talking about the epigram or Zinaida?"
"Both."
I joined him in the sitting room and sank onto the arm of the sofa. He rested a hand on my ankle, and we both smiled at the same memory. The first time we'd been intimate, the night we met at the junk shop in Kiev, he began his leisurely exploration of my body with my ankle. It was a joke of long-standing between us that he was Russia's first and foremost ankle fetishist. "Concerning the epigram," I said, "you have been torturing yourself for months. You needed to get it out of your system. You only must be careful whom you let in on the secret. As for entrusting it to Zinaida, she is a harmless creature who will evolve badly once her body goes. For now she is enthralled to be the paramour of the poet Mandelstam. Mandelstam brightened.
There is a poet of that name?
His grip tightened on my ankle, and he looked intently at me, expecting confirmation. There is, I agreed with conviction. He is not yet dead. It was almost midday when I got around to emptying the glass ashtray filled with cigarette ends into the bin immediately outside the alley door of Herzen House. And who should I come across there but Boris Pasternak, throwing out kitchen garbage after having spent the morning in another wing of the building with his future ex-wife and their son. Telling him that Mandelstam needed cheering up, I practically dragged him back to our flat. My husband was tucking his shirt into his trousers when he caught sight of Pasternak at the door behind me. He let out a howl of pleasure. "You will stay for lunch," I ordered. "We have bread and a bit of butter and two eggs. I will scare up a third from someone on our floor." I found the extra egg at the second door I knocked on. When I returned to our flat, I discovered Mandelstam standing in the middle of the living room, reciting the last lines of his Stalin epigram to Pasternak, who was sitting on the floor, his back against a wall, his face buried in his enormous hands. When Mandelstam reached the end, Boris sat there without moving a muscle.
"Well?" Mandelstam said impatiently.
"Well?" I repeated from the doorway.
Boris looked up, first at me, then at my husband. "Who knows about this?" he demanded. "The three of us," Mandelstam said, "and one friend." "Can you trust the friend?"
I answered from the door, "Yes." Springing to his feet, Boris went over to the window and pulled the interior shutters closed. Then he turned around to face us.
"You're committing suicide," he said,
his eyes grown so hollow you could barely make out the pupils in them.
"When you said you were going to let the scream emerge from the back of your throat, I didn't dream you would do something this insane."
"What Russia needs," Mandelstam observed, "is more insanity and less sanity."
Boris was so caught up in his own anguish, I don't think he heard him.
"How could you write such a poem, you, a Jew?" he blurted out.
"You're forgetting I converted to Christianity to get into university," Mandelstam replied angrily.
"Stalin and the people around him have a lot in common with the ecclesiastical tribunals of the Spanish Inquisition," Pasternak said. "For the calificadores, a Jew who converted remains a Jew in his heart, in his soul."
It was difficult to get a word in, but I managed. "I'll recite the poem to you again, Boris. You tell me exactly what in it a Jew shouldn't say."
"No, no. I don't have to hear it a second time to know that Osip has not thought this through. He is either stupid or innocent. I don't want any part of it."
Mandelstam sank onto the back of the sofa.
"Poetry is nourished by innocence, not stupidity," he said,
clearly devastated by Pasternak's reaction.
"You yourself took the position that art is risk-taking."
"I said that? Where?"
Mandelstam managed a bitter smile as he threw Pasternak's words back in his face.
"One cannot talk of art as if it were a drainpipe or a construction job, and so boil the question down to technique. To talk about the technique of writing poetry is to talk about the technique of achieving disaster. One has to remember that one needs to take risks. Nothing on earth exists without risk-taking."
Boris muttered something about having said that in another context. He turned on me furiously.
"How can you permit him to do this?"
Before I could put a word in, Mandelstam said very quietly, "We have never had a relationship that involved my asking her permission or her asking mine."
Boris was beginning to exasperate me. "You are angry," I burst out, "because you don't have the guts to do what Ossia is doing. You're not the poet he is." Mandelstam tried to cut me off. "Nadenka, you go too far."
I remember saying, "I don't go far enough. He must understand that Mandelstam has to be true to Mandelstam, not to Pasternak."
Boris looked bewildered.
"My dear Orsip, I don't recognize you any more. You have become someone else."
"When he becomes someone else," I informed Boris, taking, I will own up, a certain satisfaction from his evident bewilderment, "I am never far behind."
Boris raised a hand to his forehead and kneaded the migraine lurking under his brow.
"If you are serious about bringing Stalin down," he told Orsip, "join in the long-term political struggle." "My constitution is incapable of political struggle," my husband retorted. "I am too impatient for strategy. I only have the temperament for tactics. I am drawn to the gesture, and I believe in the power of poetry to displace mountains, along with the Kremlin mountaineer."
"At least rework the poem," Boris said with great emotion, "so that it is veiled, ambiguous, written, say, about a historical figure."
"I am through beating about the bush, Boris. A poem needs to be written that spells out the evil of Stalin so that any dense-brained idiot can understand it."
Thinking it would put an end to the argument, Mandelstam coughed up one of his favorite mantras.
"If not now, when? If not me, who?"
Shaking his head in despair, Boris turned to leave. At the door, he hesitated.
"The very least you can do, if not for your own sake, then for the friends who will hear the epigram, is rewrite the second stanza. The business about murderer and peasant slayer. It is perilously direct. I ask you, Orsip, to do this."
My husband looked at me, thinking I would challenge Pasternak. I took a deep breath and held my tongue. It was something only he could decide. I could see Mandelstam chewing on the inside of his cheek as he considered the matter. Tossing his head in frustration, he said,
"The original version had two other lines that I got rid of because they weren't straightforward enough. If it will make you feel easier, I'll eliminate the murderer and peasant slayer and restore the first version."
And he closed his eyes and recited the lines he would substitute.
"But where there's so much as half a conversation, the Kremlin's mountaineer will get his mention."
Boris said, "If you really want to make me feel easier, throw out the entire epigram." Only thinking about what my beloved husband did then makes my heart beat more rapidly. His fingers trembling, he elevated his chin and repeated the words he'd thrown into the faces of Ugor Zhitkin and his lady friends at the canteen for trolley car workers.
"I am the poet Mandelstam."
I am afraid I couldn't resist driving home the spike. As for me, I am the wife of the poet Mandelstam, and proud to be. Boris shrugged angrily as he turned toward the door. "What about those eggs?" I said.
"At a time like this, how can you think of food?"
he growled in annoyance.
"With or without those peasant slayer lines, this matter will end badly. They have treated you miserably in the last years, Orsip. If you insist on this epigram, at least you will know why they are treating you miserably. I esteem you as a poet. I love you as a brother. I wish you long life, Orsip Emelievich."
I remember being struck by how devastated Mandelstam looked. He had been counting on Pasternak's unstinting support. In my brain I can still hear his voice calling after the departing poet,
"Long life to you too, Boris Leonidovich!"
Chapter 7. Zinaida Zaitseva Antonova, Monday, the 7th of May, 1934.
How could the son of a bitch have done this to me? The way I see it, it's one thing if you're fed up with life before death and want to kill yourself. Stop jabbering about it and do it, I say. But you simply don't have the right to take others down with you. This Stalin poem of Mandelstam's is unadulterated madness. He's off his trolley, round the bend, certifiably loony. But it's his madness, not mine. I'm not even sure it's a good poem, for Christ's sake. But that's not going to stop him from reading it to all those has-been writers hanging around Herzen House. My God, what in the world can he be thinking, reading such a poem to innocent people? He has no moral right to make others accomplices to what is, after all, his crime. We live in an epoch when someone who has knowledge of treason and doesn't denounce the wrecker becomes a wrecker, subject to the same punishment as the perpetrator. It doesn't take a genius to see what's going to happen. Of the 5 or 10 or 20 who will hear the poem, one or several of them, or all of them except for poor Nadezhda, who is blinded by love, are going to reason like me. Mandelstam has a hell of a nerve putting us in the position where we could be treated as traitors for listening to his shitty little poem. Which means one or several or all of those who hear the poem will protect themselves the only way possible. They will race to the nearest militia post and denounce the author of the poem before someone else does, and the checker comes sniffing around asking you to explain, please, how come you heard this treacherous poem and didn't denounce the enemy of the people who composed it. And what would I do? Bat my eyelashes and ask, what poem are you talking about, comrade militiaman? By then they'll know the contents of the poem, down to the last comma, and the name and address and internal passport number of all those who heard it. And the ones who failed to alert the organs will be up shit's creek, as the saying goes, off to Siberia, or, heaven forbid, worse. And for what? I mean, it's not as if this little poem of Mandelstam's is going to change anything. Except the lives of those unlucky enough to hear it. Darling Orsip really didn't leave me much choice, so I don't feel as if I betrayed a trust or anything like that. Besides which, any idiot can see the poor man is trying to commit suicide. By alerting the organs, I was only doing what deep down he wanted me to do. Was I uncomfortable lengthening my life at the expense of shortening Mandelstam's? Shvoloch, bastard, you've been talking to Nadezhda. If anybody's to blame for shortening Mandelstam's life, it's his bitch. They're a folie à deux. One eggs the other on. For God's sake, what other lies did she tell you about me?
Chapter 8. Anna Andreevna, Sunday, the 13th of May, 1934. I could tell something was terribly wrong the instant I lifted the telephone handset to my ear. Borisik, his speech coming across slurred because of the magnetic storm disrupting the line linking Petersburg to the rest of Russia, announced, "You must absolutely drop whatever you're doing and come to Moscow." He said it in a way that left precious little room for argument. Somehow my dear friend Pasternak managed to sound both alarmed and deathly calm at the same time. It was his deathly calm that sent the chill down my vertebral column. I tried to tell him this was not a good moment for me to leave Petersburg. My 22-year-old son Lev, with whom I had a thorny relationship, was in town, and for once we were talking about what had gone wrong between us, rather than quarrelling about how I could have described motherhood as a bright torture. My third husband, the art historian Nikolai Punin, had secured a voucher for a 2-week holiday at one of his university's hostels on Lake Ladoga, and was dying for a break from the city. And an editor I knew had agreed to publish my critical essay on Pushkin, on condition I cut it by half. No easy chore, since I had already cut the original version by half. Borisik brushed aside my excuses, and I was beginning to get annoyed when I heard him say, "You don't understand, Anna.
our mutual friend, who shall remain nameless lest the organs are monitoring this conversation, has decided to kill himself.
Kill himself? I heard myself repeating dully.
You remember the conversation we had, the three of us, when we were watching the teardrops hurl themselves against the Cathedral of Christ the Saviour? Well, he has gone ahead with his project. I tried to convince him it was insane, but supported by that mulish wife of his, he claimed what Russia needed was less sanity and more insanity. I take the view that you are the only one who can have an influence on him in this matter. You must immediately come to Moscow and stop him before... The noise on the line blotted Borisyk out for a moment. Then I heard the words, spilt milk. Which is how I came to disappoint son and husband and editor. My husband tried to persuade me to phone the Mandelstams so Osip could meet my train, but fearing he would only talk me out of coming, I thought it better not to. As it was too late for the night train, and far too early for the morning train, I spent hours tossing sleeplessly on the bed. After a terrible row with Nikolai, who argued that Osip was a consenting adult. That if he really was determined to commit suicide, I had a moral obligation to respect his decision. Under the best of circumstances, I am an agitated traveller. Unlike Borisyk, who loves to leap onto the last wagon as it starts to pull out of the quay, I prefer to arrive at the station with time to kill. Knowing my disposition, my husband persuaded a neighbour on our embankment, who had the use of a city administration vehicle, to drive us to the Moskovsky railway station well before dawn. In the waiting room, filled with travellers curled up on benches, Nikolai spotted a public telephone and again suggested I call the Mandelstams. Was it because I was exhausted and not thinking clearly that I didn't argue? I dialed the intercity operator and gave her the number of the communal telephone in the first-floor hallway of Herzen House. After a long wait, I could hear the handset ringing on the other end. When nobody answered, the operator was ready to hang up, but I explained that it was a communal phone and begged her to keep ringing. When someone finally picked up the receiver, I asked to speak to Mandelstam.
"Do you have any idea of the hour?"
a man demanded petulantly. Before I could say a word, he informed me that there was no Mandelstam living in Herzen House. I started to insist that he was making a terrible mistake. There was certainly a Mandelstam living in Herzen House, but the line went dead in my ear. "What did he mean, there is no Mandelstam living in Herzen House?" I asked my husband, a knob of panic rising to the back of my throat.
"You make a serious error trying to read between the lines," Nikolai said, but I could see from the look in his eyes that he, too, was turning over the words as if they were stones, looking for worms of calamity beneath them. I had taken my Pushkin article with me on the train, thinking I could distract myself by reworking it, but I wound up catnapping on my hard second-class seat, my scarf bunched into a makeshift pillow so that my ear, pressed against the window-pane, would not become bruised by the jolting of the train. And I dreamed dreams so frightful I had to force myself awake to escape the anguish they imparted to my soul. No Mandelstam living in Herzen House? Had the people who left cigarette ends in Nadezhda's ashtray taken over the telephone? Were they, in the manner of Czechists, announcing the death of the poet Mandelstam? The sun was sinking below the rooftops of wooden izbars as the train crept through the Moscow suburbs, past the first factories and cooperatives with hammer and sickle devices over the arched entrances, through neighbourhoods with unpaved streets lined with newly fabricated lodgements that had come into this world with a birth defect, ugliness. It was dark out by the time we pulled into the Grand Leningradskaya railway station on Komsomolskaya Ploshchad. I lowered the compartment window and leaned out to see if I could spot a familiar face. Borisyk would have calculated which train I was on and passed word to Osip, so I told myself, So I hoped. But there were too many passengers milling on the platform, which was dimly lighted in any case. Clutching my carpet bag, I made my way through the crowd to the head of the platform. I am quite tall enough to see over the heads of people, but I climbed onto a block of cement anyhow to get a better view. I instructed my heart not to sink if Orsip didn't turn up. He could have had an appointment with an editor who was willing to publish one of his poems that beat about the bush. He could be out scouring neighborhood canteens for cheap cigarettes. When I failed to spot him, my disobedient heart sank all the same. Borisik might not have been able to get word to him for the same reason I'd been unable to get word to him, because there was no Mandelstam living in Herzenhaus. How I managed to find my way to the right trolley line, with my soul gripped by a presentiment of tragedy, my sight blurred by unshed tears, I will never know. Perhaps it was pure instinct that led me to the trolley, that helped me to purchase a ticket from the woman conductor at the back, that told me where to get off and which way to walk. Something like 40 minutes later, with my heart pounding in my ribcage, I found myself standing before the door of the Mandelstam flat in Herzenhaus. I remember raising my knuckles to knock, and then, short of breath, backing away, terrified that no one would answer. What if there was no Mandelstam living in Herzenhaus? And then I stopped breathing altogether, and knocked and strained to catch the sound of footsteps. I thought I heard a woman's voice call, "Coming!" from somewhere inside. A second later, Nadezhda was on the other side of the unopened door, demanding, "Who's there?" Somehow I managed to activate my vocal cords. "It's me," I rasped. "It's Anna." The door was flung open, and a stunned smile materialized on Nadezhda's angelic face. As it dawned on me that she wouldn't be smiling if there was no Mandelstam living in Herzenhaus, I collapsed into her arms. "Orsip, look who has turned up at our doorstep!" Nadezhda cried as she led me into their small kitchen. And there was my dear, dear Orsip in shirt-tails and suspenders, sipping tea at the table. At the sight of him I sank onto a chair and wept in relief. When I had calmed down enough to carry my end of the conversation, I explained about Borisik's summoning me to Moscow. Orsip chided me for not calling so he could meet the train, at which point I described the voice on the communal telephone, claiming there was no Mandelstam living in Herzenhaus. Orsip and Nadezhda exchanged looks. Orsip smiled grimly. Nadezhda linked her arms through her husband's and kissed him on the shoulder. "I suppose I should have told you," she said. "For some months now there have been strangers visiting our flat when we were away. From time to time I find their cigarette ends in our ashtray." I remember exclaiming, "But he knows about them, Nadezhda. He's been keeping it to himself so as not to upset you." Nadezhda stared at Orsip. "You know about the cigarette ends?" He was incredulous. "Don't tell me you have known about them, too." And the two of them, looking for all the world like mischievous children, discovering they shared a secret, laughed until the laughter turned to tears. "This is not a laughing matter," I said. They both quieted down. "Of course you are right, Anna," Nadezhda said. "If we laugh, it's out of nervousness."
"Nervous laughter," Orsip quipped, "is known to be excellent for the bowels."
"Let's talk about the poem," I suggested.
"Will you hear it?" Orsip asked.
Nadezhda touched my arm. "Do hear it," she said. "It's glorious." I agreed with a nod. Rising to his feet, Orsip tucked the shirt tails into his trousers and buttoned the top button of his collarless shirt. Taking a deep breath, tossing back his head, he began to recite.
"We live, deaf to the land beneath us. 10 steps away, no one hears our speeches.
But where there's so much as half a conversation, the Kremlin's mountaineer will get his mention.
I cannot claim to have taken in the epigram the way I usually absorb a Mandelstam poem, which is to say, as a whole, that on first hearing mesmerizes me with its mood and its music. This one lodged in my consciousness in word splinters, fragments that had no connection with each other or the whole. I admitted as much when Ossip pressed me for a comment. The English poet Eliot, in his Wasteland, claimed to have shored fragments against his ruin, I said. But your fragments will bring about your ruin.
How can you reduce my epigram to fragments? Ossip retorted, clearly displeased with my reaction.
Nadezhda, as always, rose to his defense.
Exactly what fragments are you talking about?
I was, truth be told, broken-hearted not to be able to respond more positively. But Ossip and I went back a long way. Along with my late husband, Gumilyov, we'd been poetic comrades years before Nadezhda came into his life. And the hallmark of our poetic camaraderie was absolute, even brutal, honesty. And so I told him which fragment stuck in my mind. Kremlin Mountaineer, Fingers Fat as Grubs, Cockroach Whiskers, Fawning Half-Men, and the bit about every killing being a treat for the Ossiet. Good Lord, Ossip, people have been known to vanish into prisons for suggesting that Stalin had a drop of Ossetian bandit blood in his veins, as opposed to his being pure Georgian. Undoing the top button of his shirt, Ossip settled down facing me.
You don't think it's a good poem, he said flatly.
I reached for his hand. Putting to one side its audacity, I don't think it's a good poem, no. To my ear, it doesn't even appear to be a poem. You weren't listening to the music of the words when you composed it. You had something else in mind. It's a polemic, meant to come across as a political argument. This is not something you will include in your collected works, if and when they are published. Ossip shook his head.
The insurgent Decembrists had Pushkin's political poems in their pockets when they rose up against the Tsar in Petersburg.
I remember Nadezhda bursting out, "Whether it's a good poem or a bad poem is beside the point."
Ossip said, "It's a truth-telling poem, one that doesn't beat about the bush. It's a cleansing poem that can wipe the slate clean so Russia can start over again."
I felt compelled to point out the obvious. If it becomes known, it will get you killed.
That's what Boris said, Nadezhda noted.
Borisik loves you, Ossip, as I love you. It's one thing to risk your life for a genuine poem, quite another to put your life, as well as your future poetic production, in jeopardy for a polemic. Nadezhda said, "We don't see things that way."
I smiled at the we.
Nadezhda had always been a bit envious of my relationship with Ossip. Looking back on the conversation, I think she was using it to establish that she was, after all, the wife, and I was merely a friend of long standing. The night wore on as we sat at the small four-sided table, going around in circles. Nothing I could think to say made the slightest impression on either of them. Borisik would be deeply troubled when he learned that I had had no success coaxing Ossip back across the frontier into sanity. It must have been close to midnight when we heard someone scratching at the door of the flat.
"That will be Sergei Petrovich," Nadezhda said, springing to her feet, thankful for an excuse to put an end to the discussion.
"He comes around at this hour to use our toilet and to borrow."
"Borrow what?"
Nadezhda said, "Whatever we happen to have in the way of food. He spends everything he earns on alcohol, but gets hungry before going to bed. He's not fussy. He'll accept anything. An egg, a cup of kasha, a slice of bread, with or without confiture, a pickle even."
Ossip added with a sour laugh, "Even a pickle."
While Nadezhda went to let him in,
Osip told me about their friend and neighbor Sergei Petrovich, who was living in the toiletless half of his former wife's apartment on the second floor. As the two weren't on speaking terms, he had to knock on different doors during the day to use the facilities.
He's a decent enough lyric poet, half Georgian on his mother's side. He was dismissed as the literary editor of the newspaper Komsa some while ago for publishing a Mandelstam poem, so I feel a debt toward him. Since being fired, he has been unable to find work. He makes ends meet translating an infinitely long Georgian epic poem. Because it's Georgian, everyone presumes the project is close to Stalin's heart, and so Sergei collects a monthly stipend, no matter how many or how few pages he manages to turn in.
Nadezhda returned to the kitchen, the lyric poet, with alcohol on his breath, trailing shakily after her. He plucked my hand from the table and kissed it in the French manner, barely grazing the skin with his coarse lips.
"Ochenrad," he said. "To meet the celebrated Akhmatova in person is a consummation of sorts, more gratifying than sex, which in any case I have not experienced in years."
He pulled over a wooden apple crate and, setting it on end, joined us around the table. Sergei Petrovich was as tall as I, but thin as a plank, which made him appear taller. His long, dirty white beard was matted with traces of the food he'd been able to sponge. He wore a vest over a soiled white shirt, shapeless trousers, and felt slippers, with the backs cut out because they were too small for his large feet. Armless spectacles were attached to his head by a shoelace. Nadezhda pushed the page of newspaper folded into a pouch and filled with kasha across the table to him. Sergei Petrovich managed to bow from the waist while still sitting.
"Thank you, my dears," he said. "But what I really hunger after tonight is food for thought."
He leaned forward and peered at Osip strangely.
"Everybody at Herzen House is talking about it, you know."
I smelled a rat. "Talking about what?" I asked. Swaying on his makeshift stool, Sergei Petrovich eyed Osip.
"The poem about Stalin, of course."
"Who's everybody?" I demanded. I turned on Osip in exasperation. "Did you circulate the epigram in writing?" Nadezhda answered for him. "It has never been written out. We're not fools." "How many did you read the poem to, Osip?" I asked. Nadezhda said, "In Herzen House, two or three, not counting me." Osip tossed one shoulder defiantly. "My dear Anna, it's a matter of creating ripples." "How many?" I insisted.
5 or 6. Certainly not more than 6.
Sergei Petrovich said,
7. If the poet does me the honour, I shall be number 8.
And so my poor, innocent, naive Osip pushed himself to his feet and recited it for the tosspot shit. All of it, every word, he omitted nothing. Not the Kremlin mountaineer, nor the fingers fat as grubs, nor the cockroach whiskers, nor the fawning half-men, nor the son of a bitch of an Ossete for whom every killing was a treat. My God, in light of what happened afterward, only remembering the moment makes me sick to my stomach. Sergei Petrovich fell silent when Osip had finished. Then, noisily sucking a lungful of air through his flaring nostrils, he announced ex cathedra,
"It is a truly great poem, my dears. There is no doubt about it. I am swollen with pride to have been one of your first readers, Osip Emilievich. On my deathbed I shall boast of it."
Nadezhda glanced at me triumphantly. Osip was so moved he was at a loss for words. Patting the visitor on the shoulder, he kept nodding his thanks. Sergei Petrovich wanted to know when the poem had been first conceived, whether it had been revised, who outside the 8 at Herzen House had heard it, how each of the first readers had reacted. To Orsip's credit, he answered evasively. Eventually he got into a discussion with his visitor about the poets who had defied the czars before the Bolshevik Revolution. He reached for the teapot where Nadezhda hid the poems she copied off, riffled through them until he found the one with lines from the poet Bloch, written on the back of a draft of a Mandelstam poem, and read them out. "Nothing will change. There's no way out." Carried away by Sergei Petrovich's compliments, Osip went so far as to compare himself to Lermontov, who had openly accused the Tsar of complicity in Pushkin's death and railed against the venomous wretches huddling about the throne in a greedy throng. Sergei Petrovich's head bobbed in truckling agreement.
"Lermontov's venomous wretches is the spiritual father of your rabble of thin-necked leaders, your fawning half-men."
"I hadn't thought of it that way," Osip said, "but I will concede there is something to what you say." When I was able to get a word in, I asked Osip if he happened to recall Pushkin's last words. He was in an edgy humour.
"I'm sure you'll remind me."
I did remind him. Lying on the daybed, dying from the bullet wound he'd suffered in the duel with that treacherous Frenchman Dant, he said, "Try to be forgotten. Go live in the country. Which is what you and Nadezhda ought to be doing, instead of drawing attention to yourselves with political poems." I was beginning to wonder how long the conversation would drag on. Having slept hardly at all the previous night, I was bone-tired and aching to stretch out on the sofa in the next room. As much as Nadezhda was enjoying Sergei Petrovich's visit, I could see she was suppressing yawns. Over our heads, the Swiss clock with the heavy weight hanging on the end of a chain ticked away as slowly and as loudly as ever. I suggested we move into the living room, thinking the visitor would take the hint and depart. I noticed Sergei Petrovich pulling a large watch from a fob pocket in his vest as he followed me down the hallway.
"It is late," he said, as Nadezhda and I collapsed onto the sofa and the two men brought over chairs. But he made no move to leave.
Fumbling in a pocket, Osip came up with a crumpled pack of cheap Bulgarian cigarettes. When he saw there were only two left in it, he leaped to his feet in distress.
"I hate to cut short such an agreeable evening," he said, "but I absolutely must find cigarettes."
As if by sleight of hand, Sergei Petrovich produced an unopened pack, Herzegovina floors at that, and tossed it to Osip.
"It's yours," he said so grandly you would have thought he was offering caviar and vodka.
"I wasn't aware you smoked," Osip said, examining the pack as he sank back onto his seat.
"I don't," Sergei Petrovich said. "Someone gave it to me for translating a letter. I offer the cigarettes to thank you for the use of your toilet."
"It is getting late," Nadezhda said. "Perhaps we should think of calling it a night."
"Am I keeping you up?" the visitor inquired. It was not my place to say he was, but I remember snorting aloud at his shamelessness.
Sergei Petrovich nervously checked the time on his pocket watch.
"I shall be on my way as soon as I learn how Mandelstam and Akhmatova met," he announced, looking directly at me. "I want to be able to say I heard the story from the horse's mouth."
That was more than I could tolerate. I'd reached the limits of my patience with this inebriated lyric poet, who thought my mouth resembled that of a horse. "We met after you were born, but before you started drinking," I remarked. Sergei Petrovich rolled with the punch.
"I am not offended," he told Osip, who, too much of a gentleman to evict a guest, started to describe our first meeting in 1911.
Nadezhda, who had heard the story 100 times, went off to the bedroom and came back with the quilt I always used when I slept over. And still Sergei Petrovich made no move to leave. And then we discovered why. No matter how much this hurts, I must get it right. The pain is in the details. Someone knocked softly on the door of the flat. Nadezhda glanced anxiously at the tiny watch on her wrist. Who would come calling at this hour? she asked in a hollow voice. Orsip buttoned the top button of his shirt again, almost as if he thought it would be held against him if he wasn't presentable.
"Oh, Lord," he murmured, quoting from one of his poems I first heard in the early 30s, "help me to live through this night."
Whoever was at the door rapped more sharply. Orsip said to Nadezhda very calmly,
"Will you get that, or should I?"
She rose to her feet. The blood had drained from her lips. She looked at me to see if I could fashion an answer to the question she feared to ask. I was too terrified to try. Sergei Petrovich came up with a small medicinal bottle filled with a clear liquid and took a quick swig from it. He wiped the lips that had grazed the back of my hand hours earlier on the sleeve of his shirt. Reeking of alcohol, but suddenly stone sober, he said,
"I swear on the head of my wife, I didn't know they were coming tonight."
"Who's coming tonight?"
I asked so weakly nobody heard me.
Nadezhda loomed over the guest and hissed,
"Utter one word about the epigram, Sergei, and I will circumcise you with a kitchen knife."
She ironed the wrinkles out of her skirt with the palms of her quavering hands and went to open the door. When she came back, six men crowded into the room behind her. Five of them wore the belted raincoats associated with the secret police. The sixth, dressed in a black suit with a double-breasted jacket, had the features of a raven. I have heard it said that the guttural croak of the raven can resemble human speech, but I had never experienced this until then.
It is beyond me how in the world I remember such trivia. I suppose it's because the scene is graven in my memory.
The man in the dark suit, evidently the agent in charge, approached Sergei Petrovich and, looking down at him, said,
"I have a warrant for your arrest."
Considering that the arrest of Mandelstam must have been planned down to the last detail, I couldn't help but smile uneasily at this manifestation of mistaken identity. One could almost feel sorry for the drunken collaborator, who had been dispatched to make sure the individual the checker sought would be there when they came around to collect him in the small hours of the morning, who, during the arrest, would play the role of the obligatory civilian witness required by Soviet law. This explained Sergei's endless questions, not to mention the full pack of Herzegovina floors in his pocket. Orsip stood up and addressed the officer I identified as the Raven.
"You are making a mistake, comrade enforcer of the law. He is the witness. I am the poet."
"Orsip Mandelstam?"
"I am the poet Mandelstam, yes."
"I am the Colonel Abakumov. I have a warrant for your arrest. You are charged under Article 58, covering anti-Soviet propaganda and counter-revolutionary activities."
"I don't for an instant doubt you are in possession of a warrant. Still, am I permitted to see it?"
The Raven pulled a paper from the breast pocket of his jacket. Orsip skimmed the document.
"Genrich Jagoda himself signed it," he informed us. "I suppose I must take it as a mark of esteem to be arrested on a warrant signed by the head of the Cheka."
He looked at Sergei Petrovich, who was sitting with his chin on his chest, his eyes tightly shut.
"Give me your opinion, Sergei. Would it be a stretch of the imagination to consider this signature as evidence that I am not, after all, a minor poet?"
The guest made no move to reply. The Raven addressed Orsip.
"Are you armed?"
To my astonishment, Orsip nodded.
"As a matter of fact, yes."
The Raven seemed taken aback.
"What are you armed with, and where do you conceal the weapon?"
"I am armed with the explosive power locked inside the nucleus of poems. I conceal the poems in question in my brain."
The Raven didn't think this was humorous.
"You are treating this matter more lightly than you should. One of my men will accompany you to the bedroom. You are permitted to dress.
You are permitted to collect a few personal items in a bag, including a change of undergarments.
Orsip followed an agent into the bedroom. Nadezhda said, I want to see the arrest warrant.
That is out of the question. The arrest warrant is stamped state secret. The procedure is to show it to the individual being arrested, not to every person who happens to be present at the arrest.
Where are you taking him?
Nadezhda demanded.
That too is a state secret.
Who will question him? How will he be questioned?
Methods of interrogation are a closely guarded state secret. It would help our enemies if they were to know how they would be interrogated.
Surely there are rules that must be followed in any interrogation?
There are indeed rules, the Raven agreed, but they are a state secret.
Mandelstam is a poet, an intellectual, Nadezhda burst out. He has not broken the law.
If that is the case, he has nothing to fear, and will be sent home in short order.
The agents in raincoats spread out through the apartment and started to rifle through cupboards and drawers and the hall closet, throwing the contents into a heap in the corner of the room. "Why is Yargoda taking an interest in a poet who is not even published?" I asked. The Raven shrugged.
The particulars that have resulted in Mandelstam's arrest are a state secret.
Making no effort to keep the irony out of my voice, I asked, Is there anything that's not a state secret? The Raven favored me with a thin smile.
The answer is obviously yes. But what's not a state secret is a state secret.
Orsip emerged from the bedroom. He had put on his only suit and a detachable collar, and carried a small satchel filled, I supposed, with toilet articles and spare underwear. He lingered in front of the bookshelf to pluck the small copy of Pushkin's collected works edited by Tomaszewski from it. The agent snatched it from his hands and shook it by the spine to be sure there was nothing hidden inside, then returned it. Orsip slipped it into the pocket of his suit jacket. Nadezhda tried to embrace her husband, but one of the agents stepped between them. His lips trembling, Orsip delivered a line from his Tristia cycle.
I have studied the science of goodbyes.
Nadezhda, deathly pale, completed the stanza.
The crying of women and the muse's song become one. Only God knows how I remembered lines from the same poem. Everything's happened before and will happen again, but still the moment of each meeting is sweet.
Blinded by the flood of tears in my eyes, I never saw Orsip leave. When the front door closed behind him, Nadezhda and I fell into each other's arms. The collaborator was still sitting there. One of the agents tapped him on the shoulder.
I will take your deposition in the kitchen, he said, and gestured for Sergei Petrovich to follow him from the room.
The officer and the other two agents continued ransacking the flat. Going through the shelves book by book, the Raven was quite puzzled by the absence of Marxist classics.
But where do you keep Marx and Lenin and Stalin? He asked.
I said, This is surely the first time you've arrested somebody who doesn't own a copy of Stalin's Marxism and the National Question.
Not owning a copy of Marxism and the National Question can count against someone during the interrogation,
the Raven retorted. I couldn't tell whether he was saying this in jest or not. Probably not. The search went on until dawn. Through it all, Nadezhda and I sat numbly on the sofa watching them. What they were after were handwritten documents, letters, poems, even, as it turned out, shopping lists, and to this end every book in the library was shaken by its spine. At some point we heard the collaborator, Sergei Petrovich, let himself out of the flat. Nadezhda called after him, "Don't forget the Kasha!" But if he heard her, he made no answer. Soon after, the agent came in from the kitchen, carrying Nadezhda's spare teapot. Smiling triumphantly, he lifted off the lid and turned it upside down, and the poems Nadezhda had hidden inside written on scraps of thin paper, fluttered to the floor. Every bit of paper with writing on it was collected in a satchel marked State Property. At one point during the search, the youngest of the agents, a pink-cheeked boy with blonde hair, came over to offer us rock candy from a small tin in his pocket. Both of us declined. "They're not poisoned," he said with a shrug. By the time the first of the Herzen House residents could be heard rushing through the hallway to catch the morning trolley to work, Nadezhda was dozing fitfully, her head on my shoulder, her body shuddering with muffled sobs. Near the end of the search, an agent emerged from the bedroom carrying a pile of women's shoes that had been stuffed with newspaper to keep their shape. Nadezhda came awake and took hold of my elbow. I knew that she had copied many of Orsip's unpublished poems onto the margins of Pravda articles, and, crumpling the paper, secreted them in her shoes. Seeing that the shoes were filled with newspaper, the agent tossed them onto the pile of clothing near the window. Nadezhda and I dared not look at each other, for fear the expression on our faces would give us away. When it came time for the Czechists to depart, the raven gathered up the satchel, along with a dozen or so volumes of French or Italian poetry he had decided to confiscate. "If you want to help Mandelstam, mention the arrest to no one," he advised. "Is the fact of his arrest a state secret?" I asked. The raven glared at me. "Step carefully, Akhmatova. You can be pulled in as an accomplice." And with that they were gone. I went into the kitchen to make tea. Nadezhda, barely breathing, was sitting motionless on the sofa when I returned with two cups and pressed one into her icy hand. "The bastard took the kasha when he left," I said, but I don't think she heard me.
"If they refuse to say where they took Orsip," Nadezhda asked, "how in the world will I find him?"
I sat down next to her. "There is an old trick," I told her. "You will prepare a small parcel filled with soap and socks and the like, and address it to Mandelstam Orsip. I will accompany you. Together we'll go from prison to prison and queue at the window where they accept packages for prisoners. They will check the list of inmates at the prison. If he is not there, they will turn you away. The prison that accepts the package is where he'll be."
"How do you know such things, Anna?"
Looking back, I can see now that I was taking out my rage at Orsip's arrest on her. She was agonizing over the imminent execution of a husband, an unfortunately banal situation in this workers' paradise of ours. I, on the other hand, stood to lose an irreplaceable poet brother. "Chalk it up to my having led a less sheltered existence than you," I said, my tone more vinegary than it should have been under the circumstances.
"But my life has been anything but sheltered."
"Your life may have been unconventional sexually, but sheltered from political reality. You don't understand. They are arresting people for nothing now. We are shuffled like a pack of cards. Only someone who has no grasp of political reality could have encouraged Orsip in this madness."
"That's simply not the case. We imagined prison and accepted the risks."
I could barely credit my ears.
"You imagined prison?"
Nadezhda started hyperventilating, and I had to massage her solar plexus before she could respire normally.
"What do I do after I find out where he is?" she asked in a small voice.
"We must get people to intervene on his behalf," I said. "I will alert Borisik. He will surely get in touch with Nikolai Bukharin. You must seek an interview with Bukharin and explain what happened. He has helped you and Orsip before. He will help again if he is able to. Whatever you do, don't mention the Stalin epigram. All you know is that Orsip was arrested."
"Bukharin has been out of favor since the late 20s."
"He's no longer on the Politburo, but Stalin has thrown him a bone, the editorship of Izvestia. He is said to value Bukharin's judgment."
I don't remember how long we sat there in dazed silence, sipping the tea long after it became cold, lost in thought or its absence. The Moscow morning flooded the room with a deathly slate-grey light. I do remember that the poet Tsvetaeva came to mind. I'd known the beautiful Marina when she and Osip had been briefly involved before the Bolsheviks came on the scene. At the time of Mandelstam's arrest, she was living in exile in Paris, her poetry circulating in her native land in manuscript. One of her poems that had reached me earlier in the year spoke of the Bolshevik Revolution and the deadly days of October. Sitting in the empty room that had once been filled with life and love and laughter and poetry, I suddenly heard Tsvetaeva's ominous lines ringing in my ear. Where are the swans? They went away, the swans. The ravens, too? They stayed behind, the ravens.